Oi, oi, it's your boy, Slacky J, coming at you on Friday the 1st, and we're talking about UFC 276, which most importantly has Holloway versus Volkanovski 3, but it also has some other fun stuff on it that actually looks pretty good. So yeah, fun time to be a fan, and I'm saving this bit entirely for the boycast, because obviously you can't have normal people know I actually enjoy this shit. headline is Israel Adesanya versus Jared Cannonier. I think we'll do that second because, you know, everyone who is watching this for Volkanovski versus Holloway. It's about as good a fight as ever was made. I don't know why I started speaking like the bard there, but I did. It's so high level. They've got a track record of two fantastic fights. And, this is all or nothing for Max, and it's the only good opponent he's had to fight so far in his title reign for Volkanovski. So let's get right into it. I'm going to be using this as a preview on the main channel, so people who haven't checked it out, I just opened up the Advanced Striking 2.0 Alexander Volkanovski to everyone. It's probably not the sort of thing you're used to reading, because it's all my doodles and talking about things that I really like that Alexander Volkanovski does. And there's a lot of being excited about how he uses the step up for the inside low kick to set up other things or just as a fake in itself. It's kind of in the weeds stuff. But yeah, it's I've had a few people tell me that they have had great success by copying some of the stuff in it, just in their day-to-day sparring. He's a very tricky dude. And I was thinking this because I was rewatching both fights in anticipation of talking about them today, and just because they're great fights and I hadn't watched them in a while. But it's fascinating that we had Aldo for so long, and in terms of activity, these two are the polar opposite of Jose Aldo. Aldo is as much as necessary. I'll engage as many times as I need to in a round to comfortably win it, and I will try and take their head off every single time. But I'm not going to do more than is necessary, which is why the Rob Font fight was so weird, because he won that fight on not volume. He just had like four big punches in the entire fight, but they basically won each round for him. Whereas Max was all volume all the time from very early in his career, and Volkanovski is also all volume all the time, which is a little bit more tricky because he is a bit more of a hitter than Holloway. But then that's just going on previous performance. That's not a promise of future results, because in their last fight, it was Holloway who hurt Volkanovski a lot more than Volkanovski hurt Holloway. Though Max does have one of the all-time great chins in MMA, I believe most strikes absorbed in the UFC, and nobody really talks about it because he generally wins so impressively. So I was going to write a story so far article this week, but I didn't get around to it. But I'll give you the story so far. Fight one was largely dictated by Holloway trying to jab in from his orthodox stance and Volkanovski sliding back and throwing the right low kick, often with his guard up sliding backwards. He does it in a way where it's basically just I want to say a leg kick, but think leg kick in the way we say arm punch, in that there wasn't an awful lot behind a lot of the kicks. He was just catching him as he was stepping in, and that's how you do real damage. You jar people's knees that way. And Holloway was forced to switch to southpaw about halfway through. When he was southpaw, Volkanovski kept shooting the right straight and then stepping through into a shifting right hook, and that really gave Max some trouble. But Max had more success from southpaw in that fight. Basically, the key exchange that kept playing out in that fight was that Holloway wanted to step in and combination punch, and when he jabbed in, he bladed his stance to do it, and Volkanovski would hammer his leg and fuck it all up. And he either had to choose to stand southpaw, where he didn't really box in as well, or he had to try and take it and get in, and that didn't really work. When it came to the rematch, Holloway stood shorter and was far more active in his kicking. Loads of kicks. You know, he used to throw loads of kicks. He had a fight with Anthony Pettis where he outkicked Anthony Pettis. It was just sort of a... I mean, people go through periods in their careers, and especially fighters who are good enough to adapt and learn, they get bored of one thing and they go on to another. Someone was asking me about, someone was asking on Reddit about Fedor's career and why he dropped off so abruptly. And it's like, you can look at his career He had, about, I think, 6 knockouts when he was about to meet Tim Sylvia. He'd fought 30, 40 fights by that point, but he had 6 knockouts. And everyone knew he was a massive hitter, but it was in the course of this all-around game where he was taking people down, beating them up, getting submissions. And then the last portion of his career was just all knockouts. I can't remember the last time he submitted anyone. And part of that's because he was very, very good and he got bored focusing on grappling. If you're training every day, all day, and it's your job, you want to try and mix it up in the workplace and do the things you enjoy. He always seemed to enjoy boxing a lot more. There was a lot more footage of him boxing than there was of him grappling. So people go through periods in their career where they will lose sight of some of the things that got them to the dance. In the second Volkanovski-Holloway fight, Holloway comes out, shortest stance, showing lots of kicks, and showing the floating step, the fake teep, whatever you want to call it, where you lift the lead leg, and you just hop in on your rear leg and you sort of glide in. It's not a very heavy hop. You're not going to hurt your knees doing it over time. It's the one you see all the time in Muay Thai. Helps if you teep first, or if you've got the threat of the teep, but the teep obviously not a big deal in MMA, so it's more just pick your leg up and float in. And you'll notice that Volkanovski does this all the time because he is worried about people stepping back and kicking him in the knee or kicking him in the leg and jarring his knee when he's stepping forward. You watch him against Ortega. The very first time Ortega kicks him in the leg, he immediately does a float in behind the lead leg and then a step-up lead low kick off that, which I featured in the Advanced Striking 2.0 article. That floating step is really important as a way to move in as you wanted to originally without letting the guy slide back and time your foot coming in. Now, granted, you could probably slide back far enough and get a read on that floating step, but there's a lot of other stuff going on. They could kick you. They could jump into another kick. They could just float through and step in with a shifting elbow or something. And they could always come down on the jab like they wanted to in the first place. Whereas if someone is jabbing in, there's only one place their foot can be and one thing it can be doing, and that's holding them up. And the jab was an interesting part of the second fight too, because Holloway had much more success with his jab. Basically, as Volkanovski kicked, he stood there in his short stance, he'd check the kick or he'd take the kick but in a better position to take it rather than compromised and stretched out in his stance. And the commentators are going, oh, did he do some shin condition? Did he have his thighs conditioned? Did he go home and let people kick him in the legs every day between now and then? Might have done, but also helps that he wasn't stretched out in his stance side on as he was when he was jabbing in. So he's standing there taking the kicks and just popping the jab out from the shoulder, just an arm punch rather than the step in with it. And he's catching Volkanovski on the snoot with it. Love that expression. A dude ran for, he won mayor of Chicago in the 1920s by claiming that the King of England wanted to take Chicago back. And if he got elected, he'd punch him on the snoot, which I think is fantastic. Not far removed from QAnon, which is, we're going to get into that with the QAnon warrior, Jared Cannonier, later. But whenever we're talking about this fight, I mean, jabs are important because Volkanovski has a great jab for being someone who's so much shorter than his opponents. And Holloway loves his jab and it leads into all his offense. But someone sent me a message the other day being like, Volkanovski wouldn't even push his advantages even when he had a 2-inch reach advantage. And you go, are you watching this fucking fight? Max is 5 inches taller. 2 inches of reach on someone 5 inches taller than you is not a range advantage. That's just not how it works. Try punching 5 inches up from your shoulder. And, if you're fighting someone your height, you're punching up from your shoulder. So just stand in front of a wall and put your hand out level with your shoulder so that your fingertips just touch the wall. Now move it up 5 inches without stepping closer. Very simple thought experiment there, or not even thought experiment, just practical demonstration of how height or punching up affects reach, or shortens your reach effectively. But what I really liked in that second fight also from Max, we talked about the floating step and the shorter stance, and I talked about that extensively. I think I gave him the slacky for Game Plan of the Year just because of how he turned it around from one fight to the next, and people were like, you can't give it to a losing performance. And I was like, felt he won. Get fucked. I watched it again today and I'm still surprised that Volkanovski got the scorecards. I mean, I'm not going to make a video calling it a robbery or anything, but I am still very surprised. And it just reminded me again how much I hate people who say, well, it was a close round, but to be the champ, you've got to beat the champ. You go, that's not in the official scoring criteria. What you're saying is, that would have been a 10-10 round if I weren't a moron who had his own made-up criteria to guide me. But something I don't think I talked about last time was how well Max was dealing with the lateral movement of Volkanovski. Because if you watch a Volkanovski fight, and don't think I talked about this in Advanced Dragon 2.0 either. I left myself some leeway to talk more about Volkanovski because I'll always want to. But if you notice him, there's a lot of hand checking. So he'll stretch one hand out onto the opponent's hand and then put it back, or then the other hand. And he'll do a lot of like looking at people sideways, like he's a prey animal. You know, when a bird or something sits down outside your window, they'll give you side eye, and then they'll turn their head and give you side eye on the other side. And I've got a dynamic mic, so it might have picked up me doing that. They'll give you side eye, and then they'll give you side eye on the other side. But he does that. It's also like looking at yourself in the mirror after you've combed your hair back in the diner. But there's a lot of that moving the head side to side, and then he'll throw a right kick, a right low kick and step out to his right side, or he'll fake the right low kick and step out to his right side. So there's a lot of lateral movement going on, and a lot of lateral or side-to-side head movement going on. And one of the things that I really liked about Max kicking more was that it punishes that quite well. If someone's already shorter and they're moving their head, that's a great way to make the most of being shorter. You know, the obvious examples are people like Jack Dempsey, Mike Tyson, Joe Frazier, all, of course, in a fists-only sport. But the more you can convince people to reach at you, the more you can get inside their punches, under their punches. If you can get them to punch down at you, you can come up and hit them in the head while their hands are down or while they're throwing punches low. The downside, of course, is that when guys get good at that in MMA, like KJ Nunes or Ross Pearson's the really obvious example, the secret against Ross Pearson was just to throw kicks at his head when he was bending forward. If you threw body kicks, and by body kicks I mean sort of shoulder height, so that if he slipped, he'd eat it. He then had to stand upright, so he had no head movement anymore, and you could poke him with jabs and things. All sorts of people did it to him. Masvidal did. Swanson knocked him out by kicking him in the head enough that he stood straight up. So yeah, Volkanovski doesn't go in for deep slips and things like that, but he does make use of level changes, and he does make use of moving his head side to side and stepping out to the side. And what Max was able to do with that was, if you noticed from the very first round of that rematch, he's throwing a slapping left hook, because it's not a pure left hook. He's not throwing it with a nice long stance with a pivot on his lead knee and doing the technique that would get him kneecapped by those low kicks. He's just slapping with it. It's almost open glove a lot of the time. And sometimes he's catching Volkanovski as Volkanovski's leaning towards it. Other times it's making Volkanovski lean away from it. And then you saw all those head kicks that landed or nearly landed. It always came off that slapping left. He'd do a little slap and then he'd throw his right high kick, because if Volkanovski leaned, he's bringing himself into the kick. And a lot of the time, it didn't matter where his hands were. He wasn't in great position to absorb the kick in his guard without some of it hitting him in the head. Someone was telling me the other day that the Padman's always the biggest guy in the gym in Thailand. It was just one big fat Thai, and he's the Padman. But absorbing kicks, it's serious business. These are heavy strikes, especially if you've got someone who's flexible enough to throw good high kicks. And you have to be on position to take them. You're not really on position to take kicks when you're leaning down or sliding out the side door a lot of the time. And Max also capitalized on Volkanovski's side-to-side movement. He was using his right high kick when Volkanovski moved to his left, to Volkanovski's left, that is, so towards Max's right. When Volkanovski went the other way, he timed it with the spinning back kick. And he hit him with a beautiful one in round one, which then immediately was followed by a left hook to right high kick that knocked him down. But he hit him with one in round 4-2. It was a really nice technique for him. And he's got a good back kick. He uses it at the right times. There are people who have absolutely beautiful mechanics on their back kick, but it doesn't matter. The more important thing is that you land it. And landing it means, for the most part, putting the guy to the boundary, or at least seeing that he's circling towards it, towards your kick, that is. Or you shorten up the technique and try and spin on the spot or hop into it, so that you can catch them as they're stepping in. And then there were some nice knees that he timed as Volkanovski was stepping in. And what he was able to do by not feeding easy kicks and kicking back every time that Volkanovski kicked, which led to a sort of even situation on the feet outside, Volkanovski would then try and step into punch. And through that first fight, he'd been using the shifting right hook a lot. He'd been leaping in with left hooks. He was he's a shorter guy. He has to make some distance. And in doing that, he's got to do it quite quickly, so he's putting some momentum behind himself. So if he gets hit coming in, it's kind of a big deal. And Max Holloway, tried to time him with a few knees. He landed a couple of good stepping knees to the body. But more importantly, he said, guess who's going to jail? And shot the right uppercut up the middle. One of the nicest right uppercuts I've seen in MMA. And through the first two, three rounds, it gave Volkanovski real trouble. Volkanovski got back into it by applying his own jab very well and left hook. Pursuing takedowns. Wasn't always successful with them, but just by showing them, you're more effective. And this is something that I've always criticized about Max. Very, very good fighter all round. Never even threatens the takedown most of the time. Whereas Volkanovski was showing, sometimes he's grabbing a hold and genuinely trying to get Max off his feet with all his might, as with the inside trip in the fifth round. It was, I'm going hell for leather on this. And I think he does like a big grunt as he's taking him down too. He's expending himself doing it. But he was also hitting those sort of Frankie Edgar post singles where you basically shoot your jab open palm into their lead shoulder. And at the same time, you reach down behind their lead leg. So you're pushing them in the shoulder so that their leg becomes lighter and you just run up into them and pick up their leg. And those are very low effort. You're never going to get sprawled on off doing those. You're never going to end up in a worse position off doing them. And a lot of the time you'll see people do it and then just throw the right hand immediately after as the opponent's recovering their leg. And those are the kind of takedowns that I think every striker should be threatening all the time. Because if the guy isn't with it and just gets bundled to the mat, yeah, you can sit on top of him for 2-3 minutes. If he does react to it, you've got a great chance to chin him while he's in wrestling mode or balancing mode even. Frankie Edgar used to pick it up against BJ Penn, who had amazing balance, and BJ Penn would be hopping backwards, and Frankie Edgar would just drop it and step up into a body kick or a head kick. And I think a large part of what got Volkanovski back into rounds 4 and 5 was a willingness to just bite down on his mouthpiece and step in and swing. And that's something that we were talking about in the Korean Zombie fight, but we talked about it quite a lot generally. His feints work because he's genuinely threatening when he starts trying to swing for real, and he swings for real often enough that the feints work, or that you have to respect the feints. As you can see by the, you know, fight metric stats of all his fights, as little as I respect counting strikes, but he puts out an amazing, for someone who spends so much of the fight feinting and not throwing things, he still puts in amazing numbers of real strikes thrown and landed. Which brings us to the third fight, and obviously some stuff has changed since then. It's not that we've just been waiting on an immediate rematch. There have been some sort of complications getting the rematch together, and both of them have fought twice since then. That second fight was mid-2020. And since then, obviously, Volkanovski fought Brian Ortega, smashed him, was briefly in trouble in a triangle and a guillotine attempt, but the rest of that fight was one-way domination. And Chan Sung-jung, which was a fight that most people expected him to win, but not quite as blow the back doors off. Chan Sung-jung didn't do anything. Not quite that fashion. Meanwhile, Holloway's taken on Calvin Kattar, which was an incredible rebound performance, made Kattar look absolutely clueless. And then Yair Rodriguez, where, honestly, Holloway looked bad. And there's the intrigue of it, because Holloway's coming off what I would call a bad performance against Yair Rodriguez, and Volkanovski's coming off an amazing performance against Chan Sung-jung. Now, some of that could be Chan Sung-jung being more washed than even people thought he was, and some of that could be Yair Rodriguez being better than people thought he was, and I certainly am falling on the side of Yair Rodriguez on that. I have mocked him quite a lot, because he's a flashy, spinny person, and I'm always want to mock them. But and the fact that he's one of two fighters ever to get caught for 3 missed drug tests. If you want to know how USADA works and all international drug testing, you're allowed to miss 3 tests in a 2-year period, which means that if you want to bang roids for 2 weeks, you just don't tell them where you are. Derek Brunson was telling off USADA going, I've got properties all over the US and sometimes I need to, I don't know, go cross country to fix a washing machine or something. But it's a mixed bag, because firstly, these are independent contractors, so the employer shouldn't have access at all times to them of their life. They should have freedoms, unless you're going to pay them as employees and give them all the benefits of being an employee. On the other hand, it's very easy to cheat, and people have consistently forever. USADA just means that you don't come in looking like James Irving anymore. Have you never seen James Irving in a fight? Just Google James Irving. First picture on images will probably be him doing a Superman punch, striated and huge. But anyway, I had my beefs with Yair, but I thought he looked fantastic in that Holloway fight. And what he basically did was he didn't have to fight clever. He could just throw bollocks, round kicks and stuff all the time. No setups, nothing clever, just raw athleticism and a great pace. And in that fight, Holloway had to go to the takedowns, which he so rarely shows in his usual performances, that you knew something was up and that he wasn't very comfortable on the feet with him. And they weren't that bad. You know, the wrestling wasn't that bad. It was scrambly stuff, but it's something that Max doesn't really use. Whereas Volkanovski, you're always confident that he could try and pull it out of the bag. Sorry, just being reminded of Brian Ortega's corner going, you need to shoot the blast double now. And this is a guy who's 1-19 on takedowns in his UFC career. Just going to go out and blast double through a guy who won gold at the Australian Open or something like that. But he's a good wrestler, and Brian Ortega is not. And that's always the flaw. Whenever Brian Ortega fights anyone good, you have to know that his number one skill doesn't work unless the other guy is already half knocked out or just crap at one of the key elements of MMA. But anyway, sorry, I'm rambling here. Let's talk ideas for the match. I think Volkanovski could get on the wrestling earlier, make Max defend it more. Max, very good takedown defense, tends to do a lot of work with the whizzer and the forearm across the throat, and then head posts and tries to get an underhook and circle out. Or he'll elbow on the break really well from that position. He really battered Jose Aldo. Every time Jose Aldo tried to clinch and slow the fight down, he'd head post with the overhook and the forearm across the throat, and then he'd bang the body or hit with the elbow on the break and really keep the pace of the action up. But I think for Volkanovski, get on the wrestling early. Certainly the GSP BJ Penn strategy of get some tire this guy's arms out a bit wrestling, as opposed to him having to tire them out on your head for the first two rounds. For both men, I thought body shots were sorely missing in the first fight. Volkanovski doesn't tend to punch the body as much, but does like to throw a lot of body kicks. I mean, he was body kicking even against Jose Aldo, and you should probably be worried about trying to body kick Jose Aldo because he's so slick on the counter and so hard to hit. But when Max is advertising that he's never going to try and take you down, you should definitely be throwing front kicks to his body, high kicks if you can. You know, I mean, obviously he's shorter than him, but just abuse that. Don't focus wholeheartedly on the low kicks. And of course, by throwing lots of high kicks and body kicks and drawing exchanges and so on, you can get Max into boxing, falling into his boxing, which will then have his legs coming apart and not in that shorter, ready to take a kick stance. And then you'll be able to hammer him with counter kicks. So it's a case of trying to draw him out of the shorter position where he's harder to hurt with low kicks. For Max, body punching I would love to see, because that's something that he does so consistently well against people that he's already beating. But in fights where it really would make a difference and they're close, he tends to drift away from it into headhunting, where he's not really great. He's not going to knock people out consistently. The most obvious examples are the Volkanovski fight, where he threw almost no body shots, to my recollection, and the Dustin Poirier second fight. Dustin Poirier's body is there on a platter all the time, always, because he's using his head as bait, and his shoulder roll is all focused on his head and counterpunching. And when Max went to the body punches, he was landing basically unanswered or getting away, you know, 100% of the blows were going in. But he only went to it in the fourth and fifth rounds. And you're going, well, firstly, don't start body punching in the fourth and fifth rounds, because you're committing to an idea too late. The whole plan is to have it pay dividends over rounds. But yeah, he should have been doing that. And if you watch all his best fights with people like Pettis and so on, he's kicking the body from very early on. One of the things I love about Max Holloway's kicking game is that it's not, I mean, we touched on this with the back kick, it's not mechanically pretty, but he does some things that really just piss people off and hurt them, even though they're not beautiful Lumpini-ready strikes. He'll front snap kick people in the shin. He was doing that against Pettis and I think Lamas too. He'll just front kick people in the shin, and it really looks painful more than anything. Front kicks to the body and steps in off those to land his jab. And that was something that I thought was sorely missing in this fight. I mean, we were talking about with Tenshin Takeru last week, but If you go open stance with someone, or you're fighting open stance with someone, you throw your rear leg front kick, you can step in and jab almost for free. You just have to shift. You have to change stances, so you're not doing what you're not jabbing from the stance you started on, which isn't great if you're Takeru and you don't do a lot of switch hitting. But if you're Max Holloway and you already can switch hit, go southpaw so you know he's not going to be able to buckle your knee in, and then front kick into the jab, and then start body punching from there, or combination punching. And whenever we're talking about body punching, pushing people to the fence and then disengaging is a completely legitimate form of flurrying on the body. If you watch Nate Diaz versus Conor McGregor, if you watch John Jones versus Glover Teixeira, push the man to the fence with underhooks or an overhook and underhook, the 50-50 as it's sometimes called, post your head, slip your elbows out and start banging the body with your head still posted against him. I would love to see Max do that, because the body punching, you know, Rodrigo Nogueira had success with that into his 40s because he was always slow on the feet. But pushing people to the fence, and he managed to, you know, he didn't have a lot of power, but he managed to keep it into his old age. If you push people to the fence and you post your head against them, you can make a stance while pushing them flat to the fence so that they're upright and not in a stance. And you can hit them in a position where all the speed and reactions in the world aren't going to help them. They have to unwind the position and get themselves free to stop getting hit. And another thing that I really liked in the first fight was Max taking low kicks and coming back with low kicks, or double low kicks even. But I really like taking low kicks and coming back with high kicks, because when Volkanovski, he whiffed just slightly when he did this one time in their first match, their second match. Volkanovski will throw a low kick and then try and step back and clout you with a lead hook with what is now the lead hand. It's a very common counter in Volkanovski fights. He battered Brian Ortega with it. I mentioned it in Advanced Striking 2.0. If you want to go read that, see how it's done. But if you take the low kick and then you come back with a high kick instead of pursuing him with punches, he's leaning forward at the waist, throwing this big looping blow. He's leaning into the kick, if anything. And Max came inches from hitting him with that in, I think, the third or fourth round of their second meeting. And I really liked it. I was looking at it going, yeah, might as well just throw the high kick back whenever you can, if you're confident stopping takedowns and so on. And he was pretty confident getting up. He looked good in the moments when he was taken down in the second fight. However, that's sort of, you don't want to put yourself in that situation for free, I suppose. So, yeah, low chance he pursues that tactic, but it would be nice to see lots of counter high kicks. I think the thing that I'm expecting, or not expecting, I'm expecting a cool striking fight again, but I would not be surprised if this turns into a clinch striking battle. I think I could see Volkanovski pursuing the takedown more readily. I could see Max trying to mix up his game and surprise Volkanovski with a takedown, knowing how close the last two fights were, trying to score those extra points by getting a takedown and maybe like a minute of top control. But I couldn't see either of those working effortlessly, whereas I could see them getting caught up in a clinch fight and just trading elbows and knees and things, which I'd be here for. They've given us a beautiful counter-boxing match. They gave us a slick kicking match in the second one. So, yeah, why not? Let's have a clinch striking match. It's a three stages of hell match. You have to prove yourself the better outside kickboxer, the better kicker, and the better clinch fighter. Anyway, that's enough of that fight. Let's talk about some other stuff on this card. Israel Adesanya versus Jared Cannonier, the QAnon warrior. Q posts for the first time in 2 years, and Jared Cannonier is fighting the next week. I mean, you know, it's almost like it's written in the stars. But Adesanya is coming off a hard fight against Robert Whittaker, where I think for most people, Whittaker proved that he's every bit the equal of Adesanya. A lot of people are like, yeah, cool if they fight a third time. Yeah, maybe Whittaker gets it, maybe Izzy gets it. With that and the Blachowicz fight and the Yoel Romero fight, it took some shine off the superstar that Izzy seemed to be after the first Robert Whittaker fight for the title, obviously the Kelvin Gastelum fight. Now, the Paulo Costa fight did some to help his reputation there, and Marvin Vettori was not an interesting fight, but that was largely Marvin Vettori just shooting the same double leg over and over again. Terrible game plan. Rafael Cordeiro just going, yes, more double jabs into double legs. it's weird because he's a big star for the UFC, but you can see people sort of not enjoying it as much, or him not being what people thought he was when he was coming up and smoking people. But Jerry Cannonier is quite a good matchup in terms of getting to put his skills on display, because Jerry Cannonier is, I'm not going to say similar to Izzy, but both of them are probably at their best against people who want to grapple and try and take him down. Israel Adesanya stops an amazing takedown and will just humiliate you on the feet, whereas Jared Cannonier stops a great takedown and will swing super hard for your head. So in that sense, they're both sort of sprawl and brawl type fighters. But in terms of striking pedigree, obviously, Adesanya almost won the Glory World title. Is it two losses to Alex Pereira? But the first one, he clearly won, and they just scored it for Pereira. But yeah, he's gone even and beaten some of the best names in kickboxing. He's very, very elite on the feet. And then Jared Cannonier doesn't really take people down. So this fight's almost promising the kind of fight that Izzy wants with a significant skill advantage on the feet. Add to that, the bane of Cannonier's life has been cardio, because he started as a heavyweight. He went down to light heavyweight, and then he went down to middleweight again. And basically, every time he's had to go, well, it used to be like past the first round, he'd look like crap. But, you know, recently, he slows down over the... Actually, I'm going to give him some credit here, because against Robert Whittaker, he did some damage in the last round, even though he's behind the whole fight. And against Kelvin Gastelum, he actually looked pretty good through... was that three rounds? Oh, no, that was full five rounds. Yeah, not too terrible. But mainly what he's been doing is things like the Dave Branch, Jack Hermanson, and Derek Brunson fights, where these guys come out wanting to take him down, they can't take him down, and they panic, and he just smashes them. And that's quite weird, because this is a division with not a lot of guys who want to take you down, and he's managed to fight basically all of them. Maybe Marvin Vettori at some point, and then he'll round it out. Because Marvin Vettori is the kickboxer who has done well by remembering that there's no one in this division who takes people down. But it was a nice turnaround, because the secret to beating Cannonier at heavyweight and light heavyweight was that if you touched his legs, he was done for. Ion Cutelaba, he boxed up, but every time Ion Cutelaba touched his legs, he fell over. I think he had a fight with Glover Teixeira as well. He was boxing up Glover Teixeira, one fight removed from a title fight, a world title fight, and he got taken down just any time Teixeira even hinted at wanting a takedown. He coming down from heavyweight, he's massively strong because he's used to dealing with heavyweights. And he also started training with the MMA lab and a real team and put in the work resting. So it's been quite impressive. It's just how much of that has he picked up on the offensive end and how can he use it? Because if you were game planning for Israel Adesanya with someone who didn't have Rob Whittaker speed or something like that, do you know what? I'm going to say anyone who's game planning for Israel Adesanya, whatever your plan is, whether it's to knock him out or take him down, unless it's to outpoint him, but, you know, Cannonier's game plan is either going to be knock him out or take him down, and I doubt it's take him down, but either way, it's going to be a lot easier trying to accomplish that if you can get his back to the fence and capitalize on that. And we've talked about this constantly with Marvin Vettori and so on. Double jab. Marvin Vittori's only successes in the first fight came when he double jabbed Izzy back to the fence and did some work there. And then the lesson he took away from that, instead of, wow, that double jab worked well, was to just keep backing Izzy towards the fence and shooting on his hips. And Izzy will use the fence to stop you from taking him down. It's there propping him up. So what Marvin should have been doing was using the moments along the fence to try and land good blows and then enter on takedowns, you know, make it a threat rather than Izzy going, okay, well, now I have to drop my hands to my hips and deal with a takedown and break off, maybe land a strike, and then he's going to dive in on my hips again and I'll just use the fence to prop myself up. So for Cannonier or anyone fighting Izzy, the floating step, the floating teep step, whatever you want to call it, but raising the knee and floating in, great technique, because he loves trying to low kick people as they come in. Also because it chews up ground. And then the double jab, because it chews up ground. If you're dealing with a smooth mover, chew up ground. It's pretty simple. Obviously, with every sort of killing the king sort of thing, it's not do this and you will win. It's if you don't do this, you're going to have a horrible time. You're going to be Paulo Costa, just following him around and getting beaten up. Cannonier's low kicking game actually looked pretty good when he was taking out Anderson Silva. So maybe he plays some footsie with Israel and does the Jan Blachowicz thing. Because Jan Blachowicz, yes, he benefited from being bigger than Izzy and being able to take him down, but a lot of it was just checking kicks, parrying punches, and throwing awkward counterpunches that made Izzy awkward, uncomfortable. Granted, you know, we always have to say Jan Blachowicz is a huge guy with a very long reach, and Jared Cannonier, while he did fight a heavyweight, the fact that he's comfortably making middleweight with the right diet and so on, Jan Blachowicz can't do that. So Jan Blachowicz is pretty much the bigger man, or naturally bigger man, bigger frame, so on. But talking more about Jared Cannonier as a fighter himself, not just sort of like general how to deal with Izzy strategy, one of the things that I liked about his fight with Kelvin Gastelum was the switch hitting he was doing in that fight. He was fighting successfully from southpaw as well, and I think that was the first time I'd seen him do it. And it's always cool to see someone do something new and carry it through three rounds of a decent contest with real punches going, and, you know, against a dangerous opponent, because it's hard to change yourself and move away from your A game and the things you've always done in the middle of a real fist fight. But the fact that he could is very encouraging, and I would expect him to be able to use that in this fight. Honestly, you know, if you're not going to do the double jab towards the fence and try and use ring craft to make Izzy's life harder, I think what you need to be doing is something we're going to talk about with Sean O'Malley later, but you're dealing with a switch hitter. Every time they adopt a stance, they are looking at an opening that they want to attack in your stance, and they're assuming you're going to stick to the one stance. So every time Izzy goes orthodox, he wants to hammer in the jab or the low kick. And every time he goes southpaw, he wants to hammer in the left front kick to the body, the left question mark kick, the left straight, the left knee. And what you can do to make a switch hitter's life very hard is switch stances with them. And honestly, it works better if you do it like two out of three times, you know, because you're just making the opening not the same that they wanted when they switched stance originally. So a great example would be, I had examples before this because I was using them before we talked about in the lead up to Chito Vera versus Sean O'Malley. But Sean O'Malley versus Chito Vera is a great example. If you switch stances with someone every time they switch, or not quite every time they switch, makes it very tricky for them, because a switch hitter, the whole look is chaotic. You're going, oh damn, they're fighting off both stances equally well. It's not true. They're fighting your one stance from two different looks. They know that when they switch, this is open, and then when they switch stances again, that's open. Whereas if you're switching stances too, they don't know what's open from where they end up. And there's constant moments of, oh, I've got to work out what stance he's actually on now. Or you attack and you're attacking openings that aren't quite there. So if you go, let's say you're orthodox, I'm orthodox, and I switch to go southpaw because I want to throw a left high kick. If you switch to go southpaw as well, I'm not throwing into the open side anymore. I'm throwing into the closed side. It's awkward. You're on top of me. Suddenly you're throwing back a right hook. You know, you're making an ugly fight. I'm not saying this is how you out-technique Israel Adesanya. I'm saying this is how you make a really ugly fight with someone who's pretty much, you know, very good at making pretty technical, I don't get touched fights. And hell, Yoel Romero made an awkward fight with him just by waiting on his attacks and also switching stances and not really, I mean, it wasn't as active switching stances. He just showed different stances from time to time. But if you switch every time they switch, or near enough every time they switch, you're giving them real problems. And if you're happy swanging and banging off both stances, maybe you're not a technician, maybe you just wanted to swing right hook, left hook from both stances, that's good, because you can walk someone down and chew up different distance just by switching stances when they do and making it uncomfortable. And you're going to force those ugly exchanges. It's very hard to switch stances with someone and then be like, well, I'm ahead of them now, so I know that the correct shot to throw here is this. Because they might switch stances as well. You're just forcing some chaos. Izzy's game plan? Be Izzy. I mean, it's the thing. It's the semi-shield thing. He's bringing the questions. It's your job to bring the answers. So, yeah, I could see that fight being better than expected. I think a lot of people are thinking that Cannonier is a lamb to the slaughter. He's not a very fragile guy. Certainly not at this weight has he looked fragile. So, if Izzy gets him out of there, I'll be impressed. And if Cannonier can roughhouse his way to a good fight, I'll be impressed. Is it main event worthy when Volk versus Holloway is on the card? No, but, you know, that's the UFC's tradition with heavier fighters. So what else is on this card? Well, I'll tell you what else is on this card. Fucking Jessica I, who has, I think, four appearances on Conor McGregor cards. If you don't think something suspicious is happening there, I question your naivety. It's just, how? She's not an interesting fighter. No one's asking for her. How has she ended up on all the big cards? Because that's not a fight you'd show someone if they were wanting. If someone's tuning into the prelims just on the off, you know, randomly, and you're going, here's a perfect fight to encapsulate why you should buy the pay-per-view in 2 hours' time. Jessica Rai would not be my choice. In fact, you're leading with Jessica Rose Clark and then Jessica... I mean, Jessica Rose Clark's quite fun, but two women's fights to open the night. And then Uriah Hall versus Andre Muniz. Andre Muniz is fun, but Uriah Hall is very hit and miss. Anyway, good stuff. Sean Strickland versus Alex Pereira. Sorry, I forgot that there's like a third real fight here. And Sean O'Malley versus Pedro Munoz. But Strickland versus Pereira, I don't know what to tell you about this fight because I've seen so little of Pereira against good opponents. He's a massive unknown for me. Now, the left hook is still working a charm, and it's the best weapon you could carry over from kickboxing or striking sports to MMA, especially if people are going to try and crowd you. His kickings look good. I mean, the first fight he had in the UFC was probably... That was the one where I tweeted, because he spent the whole round on the fence, and I tweeted he's gonna throw a flying knee. Right. I said something like... so Alex Pereira is going to be the throw the flying knee in the first seconds of the round kind of fighter, because, you know, he'd just been pinned to the fence for the whole round. So now he's going to come out and try some bullshit and then get pinned to the fence for the round. He came out, immediately threw a flying knee, knockout 18 seconds into the round too. People were going, damn, are you psychic? And I was just like, no, that's what people do when they're convinced that they're going to get pushed to the fence again for the rest of the round. So that wasn't a great look. He beat Bruno Silva in his last one by decision. Bruno Silva was sort of like an all-rounder, but a decent striker. And it was a good competitive fight, actually, with some, you know, powerful moments from Pereira where he was able to hurt Silva. But it certainly wasn't enough to convince me that this guy's top of the division ready. But then I look at the division, and, you know, it's all about specific matchups. Because Sean Strickland, his whole recent career has just been being awkward, tall, jabbing and leaning back and being long and tall for that weight class and having a good chin. But he's always taking shots with his chin up in the air and trying to roll them off. And you know, it's all stuff that sort of plays into a taller, longer striker who's also better than all the strikers he fought. And then Strickland, you don't see a lot of him trying to take people down. You know, if I wanted to stop Alex Pereira in his tracks, I'd put him in with someone like Marvin Vettori, who can hang on the feet but will constantly try and take you down if he knows that that's going to be the area that's going to win him the fight. If I wanted Alex Pereira the best chance of getting into a title fight, you know, one top 10 win and into the title fight, I'd pick probably Sean Strickland. Or maybe, even Gastelum can wrestle from time to time. And I don't know if Gastelum's top 10 anymore because he's basically only ever loses. But yeah, I mean, this is pretty much like, never going to say tailor-made fight, because anytime you're dealing with a top 10 fighter in the world, you never know. It might be that Sean Strickland comes out and double legs him effortlessly in round one and then just never lets up. But in terms of like, what would be the best path, the easiest possible path to try and get a title shot on this guy? This is it. For Strickland, I mean, you've got two choices here. You could try and cage hump him, but he's very strong. He's huge. If you've seen him photographed next to Glover Teixeira, he just towers over him. But he's a massive dude. He's training with Glover Teixeira, who's not a great cage wrestler, but a grindy old dude. And obviously, there's other good guys in that camp. And obviously, stronger than Strickland, probably. And that was the thing about the first Pereira fight in the UFC. I was sort of torn, because it was, if someone better can hold you to the fence for that full 5 minutes without any difficulty, they'll take you down and they'll beat you up for it. But equally, you didn't get taken down or beaten up, you just got stuck along the fence. So there wasn't a lot wrong with what he was doing, it was just taking him a long time to disengage, which is one of the things about Israel Adesanya that impresses me all the time. The hardest part in the modern MMA cage fight, wall wrestling meta, almost everyone can get up eventually. You know, Conor McGregor stood up from underneath Khabib Nurmagomedov a couple of times. People will get up because the wall walk is extremely powerful. The problem is disengaging, because if you can't disengage, you're then stuck on the wall and they're going to take you down again. Israel Adesanya is one of the very few guys who's very, very good at disengaging. And sometimes he'll throw himself into back body lock to break the hands apart and get away. Sometimes he'll get the underhook and turn the opponent on the defense. You know, there's a lot of techniques you can use to break away. It's just that guys aren't coming out on the winning end of it from the cage side part of the equation anymore, for the most part. So that's the thing with Pereira. I could see him getting stuck to the cage. But the other performance that Sean Strickland could have here is to just go out throwing punches, kicks. I'd throw high kicks if I were advising him. I'd say throw some high kicks and some punches. Go out like you want to take his head off, because Pereira's going to throw back a high kick, you know, either to throw a high kick to hurt him or to set up the left hook, because he loves throwing the kick and then coming off it with the left hook. Throw kicks, get him throwing kicks back, and catch kicks and run into takedowns in the open would be my advice, because he's been training forever on the understanding that people are going to push him to the fence and try and take him down along there. If you can get takedowns out in the open, much easier. And the number of guys who actually catch kicks and capitalize on them well in MMA is very, very small. But this, I mean, again, with anything like this, this is me talking about things that they should have been working on for 3 months if they wanted to apply them in this fight. I'm not saying, Sean Strickland, if you're listening to this podcast, do this now. I'm very interested in see how that fight goes. For Pereira, I would probably fight cagey on the feet, try and keep it in the center, let Strickland throw, and then try and come back with high kicks. Because, you know, I just said that, you know, Strickland should be trying to draw high kicks and catch them. But Strickland loves poking people and then leaning way back. It's his whole thing, just leaning straight back. And that won't work against people who are, one, good strikers, two, longer than him and will follow him back. So double jab into high kick or double jab into right straight or whatever, but just cover some distance. And Pereira is very good at covering distance. If you watch his fights in glory, some of them, he'll stand in like a peekaboo, hands high, square on stance, and he'll just leap across the ring with a 1-2. Honestly, for the sport, probably the best thing that can happen here is Pereira wins and they do the... And fuck, Kennedy doesn't win. But the best thing they can do is Pereira gets a good knockout on the undercard of... Not the undercard, on the main card of the Israel Adesanya fight. They set up that obviously marketable rematch. And I think that would be huge for MMA. And honestly, when we're talking about matchups, making fights and getting someone the correct path with matchups as they're trying to do with Pereira, the Adesanya fight, you know, I think some questionable or morally sketchy stuff has to be done to get him there as soon as possible, because there's your Derek Brunsons, your Marvin Vittoris, your people like that, or Robert Whittaker, who I think would give Pereira a horrible time, and he's just sort of bypassing them because there's not a lot going on in the division, and we want that to happen. But Israel Adesanya versus Pereira, Izzy doesn't take people down. You know, you're going to have a 4-ounce kickboxing match with some clinch work, and that sounds phenomenal, and totally winnable for Pereira. You know, with his power and I want to say kept up with Izzy, but he was on the slower end for most of their first fight and much of their second fight, but. Obviously, he's 2-0 in kickboxing matches against him, no matter how much I say he lost the first fight. So, yeah, honestly, that would be great if that happened and they managed to put that together. Now, Sean O'Malley versus Pedro Munhoz. Basically, Sean O'Malley's best opponent so far, ranking-wise, which is weird because he was saying that he didn't want good opponents until they paid him more. But Munhoz coming off the loss to Dominic Cruz and the loss to Jose Aldo... win over Jimmy Rivera, lost to Frankie Edgar, lost to Aljamain Sterling. I mean, Pedro Munhoz is basically just a guillotine and a calf kick. And, you know, he's added a jab sort of in the last few years, but mainly the calf kick. He lives and dies by it. He used to just throw the thigh kick as a naked lead and guys would grab it and he'd guillotine them. Then he learned about the calf kick and that became his whole thing. On the one hand... Sean O'Malley, obviously famously brittle-boned, lost that fight to Marlon Vera off a leg injury, got hurt against Sukmatash by leg injury. And of course, you know, he fights in a long bouncy stance, so kicking his legs is always going to be a priority. On the other hand, if he switches to southpaw, which he does throughout fights constantly, Pedro Munhoz doesn't have anything to kick. Pedro Munoz isn't going to do a step-up left calf kick, probably. You know, his whole thing is right calf kicks. Pedro Munoz is also very, very short compared to Sugar Sean O'Malley. So I would expect lots of front kicks to the body off the rear leg and then try to bounce back with the counterpunch as he did against Thomas Almeida and others. Or trying to sneak through long left straights and long right straights as he did against Eddie Wineland and Sigmatash. I think the interest here is that, yeah, it's going to be harder for Pedro Munoz to land his kicks because Sean O'Malley does lots of work from southpaw. But Sean O'Malley does love to switch stances. And I think Pedro Munoz is going to be throwing it whenever he can. Whereas a lot of guys would be put off by the stance switching from throwing the kick. I think because it is basically all that Pedro Munoz does, that adds some intrigue. Pedro Munoz, not a bad wrestler, so interested to see if he can make something happen there. Tends to be pretty good going forward and pressuring people. A lot of his more famous fights, he's been sort of trying to, fighting with his back towards the cage, not on the cage, but back towards the cage. But I've seen him move forward, so it'd be interesting to see if he can push O'Malley towards the fence. It's like, yes, a lot of Pedro Munoz's defense and stuff, I'm not convinced will hold up to O'Malley's offensive skill and speed and length. But equally, Pedro Munoz's one thing is the thing that really fucks up Sean O'Malley's day. So not a ton of info I can give you on that fight, but just that key point is enough to make it interesting. Brad Riddell versus Jaylen Turner, always fun. Brad Riddell, I think that recent loss to Rafael Fiziev, you know, that was razor thin until the wheel kick, basically. A really fun back and forth fight. Beat Drew Dober just before that. I mean, he's a good guy. Magomed Mustaev, a very hard fighter as well. But Jaylen Turner's on a terrific little tear, because I remember watching him against Vicente Luque and going, this guy has no idea what he's doing. And now he's on, I think, a four-fight finishing streak, not even winning streak. Jamie Malarkey, Medic, Weaver, and Koulibal. So good chance that's fun. Robbie Lawler's back against Brian Barberena. But this is quite interesting, because Robbie Lawler, I mean, he's got the win over Nick Diaz a little while ago, but before that, he was on a three-fight losing streak. He's old now. He's 40 years old. I mean, his UFC title run was a career resurgence anyway. He'd sort of had his best days, and then he revamped himself and came to the UFC and won the title. But Brian Barberena is only 33, I think, and he's sort of perfect for these old men of the division, because he's not quite good enough to be in the UFC as a 33-year-old, but he's good as a matchup for these old guys they want to keep around. That'll be a fun fight. And then Donald Cerrone versus Jim Miller. I mean, you've got to expect Jim Miller picks that one up, because Donald Cerrone's looked so fragile and slow lately. But, you know, their first fight, Donald Cerrone threw the front kick to the body. Jim Miller couldn't do anything about it, so Donald Cerrone just threw it 40 more times. Ian Garry's fighting Gabe Green. We all hope Ian Garry loses that, because it'd be hilarious, but no idea. Brad Tavares versus Dricus du Plessis. I love du Plessis. Uriah Hall versus Andre Muniz, and then we're down into the lady fights that we talked about earlier. So yeah, really good night of fights. Can't wait, and I'll be doing my post-fight breakdown on Sunday. Hopefully there's some good shit to talk about. You know where to find all my shit. I'm your boy Jack Slack. Jared Cannonier hiding a crystal under his hand wraps. Bless.